Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, we got John Mastner in the house. John, how are you, sir?
Doing well. How are you?
I'm great. Yeah, we got Tony and myself. So, John, for those who don't know you, take a second, brag about yourself. We know you've got some history in hunting the bad guys, and now you're in the hiring space. You do all sorts of stuff. So, yeah, take a second, brag about yourself. Tell the people who John is.
Sure. So my background, I worked for the American government, working primarily at the State Department. So living and working abroad, I lived in South America, North Africa, and the Middle East. Got out, started buying small and operationally difficult to run businesses. And as a result of that, got good operationally in terms of hiring globally, which is how I spend most of my time now, but also using kind of automation, and AI wasn't around when I was doing this. But I've now spun that into a bunch of different efforts and have had a lot of fun and a lot of success. The big thing that I write and talk about a lot is leverage, is how to get a big output from a small input. I wrote a newsletter about that, do some advisory work, and like building and buying small businesses and growing them. So that's my background.
Fantastic. Love it. First question that I'm sure a lot of people, or at least I ask these questions selfishly: how did you afford to buy all these businesses when you first got out? Like, or were you just really good at saving? Did you buy them for cheap? How'd you get that equity?
So when I got out of the government, I was raising foreign direct investment. That's what was like my first thing I was doing out of the government, which is think commission-based sales, but for investment. And because it was very similar to my previous job. And as a result of that, was able to establish relationships with folks who didn't mind writing equity checks into US-based businesses. So that's how I first did it, was that way, with my relationships with retail investors overseas.
Love it. And just before we started talking, or just recording, we were talking about, one thing you mentioned was AI and automation. So what are some things that you do with AI that you think most people don't, or most people misunderstand about the best way to use AI to actually scale a business versus just as a toy?
So I gave a talk at a conference about this. I created like this triangle, this hierarchy, which is you have to hold other factors around a business equal. But the way that I think about it is, the triangle is about how work gets done in a company. At the very top of the triangle is the owner. Then below that are local employees. Then below that is global talent. And then below that is AI and automation. And your goal as a business owner is to try to push as much work of your company to the lowest level possible, but no lower. And so the way that I think about it is things that start with me, like, let's use a silly example. One that I use all the time, writing memos. 5 years ago, I wrote all my memos by hand. 3 years ago, I had my front desk guy do it for me. I would, talk and he would take notes. 2 years ago, I would send a voice note to my person in the Philippines. And now I use a Dropbox trigger to take a voice note, Whisper API, stick it into ChatGPT, and then it outputs a memo for me, ready to go. So that's an example of how you as a business owner, when you're talking about creating enterprise value, building better margins, I think of it as creating the systems that allow you to push things down that pyramid. And so I've been pretty successful in doing that, which means I get to build great businesses and don't have as much heartburn. So that's how I think about it. And there's a lot of different ways to do that. A great, easy place to start is things that are currently done and being done with global talent are oftentimes the best places to look to automation.
Yeah, I would agree with that, and I would also say that there's sometimes I'm sure you run into this too, like where people will say, "Well, I want to automate because I don't want to pay the $500 a month for the person in the Philippines or whatever." And like I would say, like, yes, there's a degree of truth in the sense that AI can, or automation can, save you money, but if you don't want to pay for somebody else to delegate, if you're that poor, or the system just doesn't seem that worthwhile to you. Like, it's probably a sign there's another problem in the mix somewhere. Like, you don't have enough revenue, or you don't value the skill of delegation.
I think that much. I think it's when I think about what prevents people from moving things down the pyramid, generally speaking, it's lack of systemization. They're not clear on what a qualified lead is. They're not clear on how work flows through their business. So when I talk to business owners who are kind of below a certain level, the way that I think about it is drive sales and then delegate and automate. But you have to be driving sales, because if you don't have revenue, nothing matters. And so based on the industry, in my experience, it usually is around $1 million a year in revenue, where they can start thinking more about how work gets done rather than just doing all the fulfillment yourself. Now, again, if it's SaaS, the number's way lower than that. If it's a restaurant, the number's way higher than that. It's somewhat based on cost of goods sold and things like that. But broadly speaking, I find around $1 million in revenue, we can actually start looking at how work gets done in your company more systematically. And if they're below that, the answer is you need to sell more before you start thinking about delegating and automating. Go build a reliable sales channel. That's what I usually
do. I just tweeted about this today, actually, where this, I think a lot of the problems can be, or you can quickly reveal systems problems by just like getting more clients. And the role of systems is not to, I think a lot of people use, or a lot of the discussion I hear around systems and like automation and stuff is like, as a thing that you should do as much as possible of. And I would, like, as an automation guy, it's like nice to hear that people value your work. But at the end of the day, your job is not to make as many SOPs or as many flow charts or as many automations as possible. Your job is to solve problems that scale the business and to like scale the business. So if you, I think there's a lot of times where people, if they're uncomfortable with the prospect of selling or expanding a business, they will fall back on automation as like a, or like systems and tweaking their
as a nice to have,
as like a form of like productive procrastination, right? I will say, like, I think the business model drives a lot of like where things are at, but yeah, about $1 million a year is, I mean, certainly above that. It depends, like info products, I would say $1 million a year is maybe on the low side.
Correct. Depends on the company.
Like what your
but that's just what I've seen roughly. Yeah, that's roughly what I've seen, and it's. It's even more than the business model. To me, it's actually the cost of goods sold, right? Meaning how much margin are you making on that million?
Right, right.
It's really driven by COGS, in my opinion.
It's nothing. It's nothing like a business owner who gets like two clients per month or one new client per month, but thinks that not having an onboarding automation is what's stopping it from growing.
Exactly. Yeah, and I think there's a phrase from I listen to a lot of stuff about. Manufacturing principles like lean and things like that, because I steal a lot of it for my businesses that are all white collar, right? And for services and things like that. And there's a great phrase that I really like, which is people say, "Oh, where do I get started with lean manufacturing?" And the phrase they use is "fix what bugs you." And I say the same thing too with global talent or AI and automation, which is just fix what bugs you. Like focus on that. Don't write an SOP unless you need to, unless there's something that's bugging you, right?
That's not
an end in and of itself, right? Like, don't automate something because it's cool. Automate something because it's going to let you scale faster and make more sales and not roll out your fulfillment. So I like the phrase, fix what bugs you, you know?
Yeah. Tony, it almost sounds like John is like snoping in on all of our client calls, because like this whole...
Right.
I come from a manufacturing background, actually. So I used to...
Whoa. Okay. So
like,
you know Lean.
Like very... Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Like Six Sigma and 5S and all that stuff. So for those who don't know, or who haven't been on Tony and I's and John's calls with their team and various things, Henry Ford stole the idea. He borrowed the idea of the assembly line from... a slaughterhouse. And so he like visited Henry Ford, of course, like inventor of Ford cars. So he goes to the slaughterhouse and sees like this, these people standing in one place where the carcasses were moving from station to station. So the people were stationary, the carcasses were moving. And so one of the things actually we implement in our clients' businesses as well is like this whole idea of rather than having like a project with like a bunch of tasks and subtasks that must be done, we build like a process that's very much like a digital assembly line where you have like one layer. If you're producing landing pages or videos or, you know, email campaigns or whatever the thing is like your business is producing, you model the various rather than tasks that must be completed, you model it as stages that this thing must pass through on its way to the finish line of the kind of digital manufacturing process. So super, super interesting. Like we found people really love this idea of, and it's super interesting that like we both independently came to that conclusion, right? Of the manufacturing analogy. But I really like it because like what's crazy is companies like Nestle and Mars Chocolate makes, you know, Snickers bars and stuff. And they used to be my clients. So I've seen these processes, and they sell these chocolate bars for $1 a piece, but they still make billions a year. And so it's obviously working, and it's been working for decades for them. This is quite phenomenal how manufacturing actually works if you compare it to almost any other business model.
What I find is the more I can make white collar work like manufacturing, the more I can have a predictable output. And so I think a lot about people say, oh, I just get emails and they turn into proposals. That a lot of when I'm improving my companies or finding opportunities to use global talent or finding opportunities to use AI and automation, it starts by being very clear about input, output, transformation, trigger, right? And so it's like, how do you know when you get it? Well, we get an email. Okay. Then how do I turn that email into a draft landing page? Well, the first thing we do is look at the client intake form, right? And so the more I can break it down, that to me is having a clear, discrete process or a recipe or whatever you want to call it, then allows for someone smart like you guys or me or my team, or I have a bunch, you know, I have a big team now, is we look at it and we go, okay, so from this stage to this stage, all you're really doing is extracting these three pieces of information and sticking it in this Airtable or whatever it is. And it's like, awesome. I used to do that by hand. Then I had my local person do it. Now I have somebody in Colombia do it. And oh, by the way, there's a new parsing feature in Zapier. AI can do it now. Done. Right. And so by being clear, it enables us to build more leverage into the way we deliver our work. So that's how I like to think about it. And it's served me extremely well because I am exceptionally lazy. So
how did you come to the manufacturing analogy? Was that through businesses you'd bought or upbringing? Like for me, it was just like after university, happened to work at an engineering company that had clients in the manufacturing.
Yeah. So I'm a sales guy. I'm a sales guy but I read a ton and I read really widely. And I think that, I like stealing from other sectors, you know? And so I think for me, it just started by reading really widely in order to steal ideas and concepts. I'll give you another one, by the way, that I stole from Henry Ford that you'll like since you mentioned him. Mm. It was just self-taught. It was out of, hey, who knows how to set up really good, precise outputs using low-skilled employees? Well, manufacturing knows how to do that.
Right.
Why is bookkeeping different? It's not. It's just not. It's input-output transformation, right? So I ended up just going down the path of studying those methodologies so that I could steal the core concepts. It's just pure theft. But it works really well. That's how I did it.
Interesting. What was the other concept from Henry Ford you mentioned?
We have this whole thing. But do you know that a byproduct of the Model T production was charcoal, right?
So are you talking about like reusing your sawdust or what?
Correct. It's called? Yeah. Byproduct. So I read that in some book or whatever. And so one of the things that we do in one of our companies is we hire so many people, around the world that very often we have extra candidates, who've already passed all of our vetting. And one of the things that we do for the members in our current business is we give those candidates to them for free. Because it's basically our byproduct, and I totally lifted it from Henry Ford. It could totally be its own independent business, but we actually b- bundle it as a benefit, but it was basically monetizing a byproduct of a different part of our business, which is cool.
Interesting. Love that. Yeah. What kind of KPIs do you, so like, we walk through how we, the KPIs we track for a process. But I'm curious for you, what kinds of KPIs do you measure for your businesses?
It depends on the, business. I don't know if I can give a great general answer, but if we talk specifically, then it varies. Broadly speaking, I'm looking at unit economics, contribution margin, customer acquisition cost, LTV. Those would probably be the big ones that are fairly universal. Gross margins, things like that. Mm. And then beyond the next level would be more specific to the actual business, like what it's producing or what service it's providing.
Yeah.
Are you a fan of constraining the process to get more consistency out of the output?
What do you mean by constraining?
So you mentioned like the recipes and like what is a qualified lead? What is an email? Yep. Like how do you sort of go about thinking about that way?
Yeah, the way that I think about it is pretty universal. So step one is, first, I think about, and there's a great book called Output Thinking, John Seifert. Mm. The first thing I do is I look at what the company does. Okay, our job is to deliver automations. Great. Then I look at the sub-functions within that company, whether that's the customer acquisition process or whatever. Then I look at somebody who says, they're basically currently you can only have one constraint at a time, right? Theory of constraints stuff. I look at who is the sticking part of the company. Then what I do is I have them, in conjunction with me or one of my members of the team, list out all of their outputs. So what are the outputs of this role? And that's problem solving, a behavior, a thing, a change of status, a relationship, and there's like one other type of output. Then we look at all those outputs and we list them out. And then the first thing that I attack are the low end of their outputs. So you're a lawyer who bills out at $600 an hour. One of your outputs is drafting NDA language, and that shit is easy. So then I start attacking the low end of their outputs as a way to systematize, delegate, automate, whatever, and let them keep the high end outputs, the ones that are really, you know, everybody plays at the top of their game, right? So I let them keep the top of their game, but then I look to either bring in automation, AI, or global talent to take out some of the bottom end of their output so that they can unlock more capacity. That's how I think about it.
Love it.
Yeah, there's a lot there, but that's how I think about it. Long answer to a short question. And the way, Tony, obviously the way that you push outputs to a lower skilled employee or an automation is you set the standard. Meaning this is what good looks like. And this is what a qualified lead is. This is, right, you externalize the high skill into a way of doing business. You define end state. You define what good looks like. And then you train and enforce the steps to get to that good output, which is a draft NDA or whatever it is. And so that's how you systematize a company and build enterprise value. You guys know that. But that's how I think about it.
Love it. That's like the whole difference between like SOPs and trainings. Like trainings are how we think about things, and SOPs is like, how do we deliver the exact same output we're looking for?
I think also when people hear us talk about SOPs, the big thing too that I emphasize, which is an SOP when you're first getting started can just be an end state. That's it. Here's what a good one looks like. That's how it starts. It doesn't need to be where you fucking click. You want to build it out over time because you have some reason to, great. But an end state could just simply be what a good job looks like. Hey, here's what a client proposal looks like. This is the end state. And you keep all of what good looks like as examples. Don't spaz out and think you need to have a 78-step process, right? Just define the end state. If you just define the end state or define the output, everyone will have our brand. Everyone will have the customer name. Everyone will have these three things. That is half the battle. Then if you want to fill it in with some trickier steps, whatever, that's fine. But don't be intimidated by the idea of writing SOPs, in my experience.
Love it. Now that's a big bottleneck for a lot of people, just trying to grasp their head around how do you even start.
Yep. If they have money too, I I have a company that writes these for them. It's done for you SOPs. It's called Team Wiki. We build out your Notion. I don't run it, but I help co-found it. So it's great. They do interviews with your team on Zoom, and then they turn those into SOPs. You know who are the biggest customers that we have for that service are actually automation guys. Because once you have all the SOPs down, it's easy as shit to automate. It's the hard part is actually getting it out.
Interesting. So it's almost like like a white label. Like you almost want to say, oh yeah, our offer is we will interview you.
Yep.
And then you have the interviewers pass off some of that stuff to the automation team. Automate some of it. Interesting.
So it's like a diagnosis where you can't automate something until you talk to Beth in accounts receivable.
Right.
But automators don't really want to, you know, wade through all the garbage associated with actually writing down what Beth does all day. And so you kick it to them. But as you start to write stuff down, what that does is it reveals opportunities for automation or global.
Right, talent. Right, right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's exactly what, I mean, that's exactly what we do, except we have those same people, in-house, although it's like I'm sure there's a lot of that's an interesting opportunity actually.
I split it out of my global talent business because we were doing it as a way to make people successful with global talent, which is unless you have a way of doing business, these people are going to flail. And right. So we started doing it as a part of that, and then people were saying, hey, can you do this for the rest of my company, not just the global talent?
Oh, so yeah, so they were hiring for one role out of like whatever 100
right.
staff.
They'd say,
have.
I need a community manager. And we're like, awesome, we'll do that, but you got to talk to us about what a good job looks like. And they would talk,
right?
And then
right.
we would attach that to the community.
And they would
manager,
say, that's right. awesome. Can you do this for every other role?
Correct. Can you do it? Can you do it for my normal people?
Haven't done it. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Exactly. Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah, I like that. I like the kind of the sawdust, the Henry Ford Cole approach. It is interesting, like hearing, for me, it's fascinating when people have a constraint. So in the good old days, there was no computers, no robots. It was just people, and all they had to deal with was how do we make as many Model Ts as possible with the manual workers we have, right? And he still found a way to make it more organized and streamlined and make more money out of this very manual process, right? Back in the day, I don't know if you know this, but manufacturing companies used to do automation before there was computers. They did it with switches,
punch cards,
relays. Shit, right? Well, no, but this is even like punch cards were like programming computers, like actual computers. So I'm talking about like an electronic relay. So you have
turning stuff on.
Eye,
yeah,
like a photo eye, and when there's a box that passes a photo eye, it would.
Wow.
A photodiode would read, it was like, oh, there's no more current coming into me. And then that would use through a relay to turn off a motor. And so even like 10, 15 years ago when I was doing stuff in manufacturing, the technology, like the computer technology, you like open up Microsoft Windows and install this software on the computer. The software that they use is modeled to look like an electrical drawing because these guys that have been working in the factory for 30 to 40 years, the electrical drawing is just what they've always used. Like manufacturing from a technology perspective is actually extremely far behind everything else because they've just been running this process for 30 years exactly like this. And everyone's terrified of changing it because it works. It works good enough because they never turn it off. They just run it all the time.
Yeah.
They'll turn it off like once every 6 months to clean some stuff or do maintenance on a motor or something like that. But for the most part, they just it's the simplest computer in the world because it pretty much just turns on and always is on. And so the logic is very, very simple, but the technology is super interesting. It's like it was based off of relays and they were literally just wiring things together to make the logic. Like if two relays were in series, it was an AND. And if two relays were in parallel, it was an OR.
Love it.
And that was how they did it. Yeah.
Love it. Love it.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like, have you seen the Imitation Game?
I have. Yeah.
Okay. So it's imagine that. So like the Imitation Game. So, Turing. What's his name?
Alan Turing.
Thank you very much. So, for those who want a little bit of like a lesson in computer science history, Alan Turing was this guy who he basically worked for the British government. He was the subject of the movie The Imitation Game. Awesome movie. And what they basically did was they built a computer out of mechanical parts before there was computers. And or I don't know, maybe there was computers, but they effectively built a computer out of mechanical parts that did something called brute force like encryption. And that's how they cracked the code. It's just like a bunch of motors just running all the
time. There's some incredible YouTubes about Enigma, which was the coding machine the Germans were using and how they cracked it. If you're interested in that kind of thing, just Google like Enigma code breaking. Super interesting. Super, super interesting.
I got to watch that because like I studied engineering in university. And so we were taught about the Turing test, which is this... It's kind of a thought experiment, kind of not, where you engage with something and your job. It's like, imagine like talking to ChatGPT. And so the Turing test is basically like, can you tell as a human, can you tell that ChatGPT is a robot, or are you fooled and think it's a computer? And if it passes the Turing, if you as a human think that you're engaging with a computer, then the AI failed the Turing test. And it's the Turing test is named after this guy who built a computer out of like not electrical parts, mechanical parts. And so like something called a transistor, I don't know if you guys are familiar with like, so transistor is basically an electrical version of a small little switch that can turn on and turn off. And this is something called like, so the Moore's law, you know, anybody who's like read a blog or you've read The Hustle or whatever else, people talk about Moore's law of like the cost of transistors is going down at an exponential rate. And so that's how they predict like the cost of, you know, how much a MacBook Pro is going to cost in 20 years or whatever it is. So yeah, I got to check out some of those YouTube videos though on Enigma. Cause like that kind of stuff is
very well worth it.
Like it's fantastic. It's amazing.
Very well worth it.
What people were capable of when they had zero technology, or like the Greeks that figured out that the Earth revolves around the sun when all they had was like basically just sticks, sticks in the sunlight and a few rocks to toss.
Incredible.
Around.
Incredible.
Like, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. What do you think are some of the tools right now? No, everyone knows ChatGPT. Everyone knows the large AI models. What are some of the tech stacks, some of the tools that you are seeing right now as like really useful for the market?
Obviously, what's the new name for Code Interpreter? I still call it Code Interpreter. I don't know what
it's actually called now. The other day.
Data Analyst or something? But it's Code Interpreter to me, which is businesses. I was talking to a business owner who owns a tree trimming company, and he exported the call records from he was trying to think about when he should staff his next CSR, hire a new person. I was going to help him hire. And he's like, oh, I don't know when they should work. And I said, he uses a soft phone, air call, whatever. And I said, export all of the call records, put it in a Excel, and then upload it into Code Interpreter. And it can give you got to go back and forth it a couple of times, but it gave him this wonderful plot of when his calls came in and when he was missing calls. And we knew exactly when he needed to staff a person. So you get like this junior data analyst for freaking nothing. It took them 20 minutes. That would be an example of one. Code Interpreter, I think, is something that people don't understand the implications of. It's absolutely insane.
The second one
that I'm very, very bullish on, sounds like you guys are, or maybe you use some of it, which is especially for these brick and mortar businesses. I think over the next 10 years, we're about to have an explosion in voice because Whisper has gotten good enough where it is insanely useful. And voice to me is, you can now take voice and turn it into structured data. So as an example, we built a tool just internally where our field sales reps who didn't use computers, they didn't use apps, they forgot their logins, could just call into a number. And we had Whisper. It was just like Twilio, Whisper, some chat, OpenAI. And we were able to extract information. We could even program it to ask him questions. Then we could then extract certain information and then put it in an Airtable base. And now it's like, so my Mexican American crew dude who never remembers his login, he's never going to use CRM, doesn't sit behind a desk, could call in and we could figure out all sorts of stuff from that, right? And so voice, I think, is about to have a renaissance. Or not a renaissance, but I think voice is really going to start exploding because voice is by far the easiest way to communicate with machines. And so my big thing, I'm using voice like crazy personally. I'm using it in my own kind of way that I do my own work, but I think voice is about to fucking explode.
Interesting. So that's fascinating. I think like the thing or the lesson that I take from that is, And I had this lesson for myself, right? Recently, I built a content repurposing system. And for the longest time, I thought to myself, we do about 150 to 100 features per week for clients. And so I thought to myself, well, I should market as many of these as possible. I should take screenshots and tell people about all the stuff we built. And then I struggled for like weeks and weeks and weeks because it just didn't like, I felt a resistance to that, and that, like psychologically, it didn't click, right? And then finally, I realized, well, hold on a second, I don't actually need to market everything. There's some things I just find into. I just want to talk about some stuff, and there's other stuff I don't want to talk about. So rather than the interface being okay, I'm going to get this entire list of more than 1,000, 1,500 or so features for clients, and try to just market all of them. I just went through and screenshotted the fun stuff and social proof from Slack and social, like, screenshots of testimonial videos and screenshots of whatever and dumped them all in a folder and said, okay, I'm going to just make an automation that just grabs these, makes a row for each of them and allows me to repurpose posts across social platforms, about each of these images. And it was crazy how much easier it was to create content. Simply because the interfaces was different. So rather than the interface being a list, it was a photo, and that was it. And it had the photo, of course, had a lot of the idea of the content within it. But I think that's we personally don't use voice, or we don't a lot anyways. But I think that's super interesting because it really is. I can speak from personal experience here for me anyway. Changing the interface, making the interface more natural.
Correct.
We use this with like some of our clients use, like we have a client that does like Amazon stuff and they constantly get these like tickets and emails and stuff from Amazon. So like building a mail hook that grabs all the information from the email automatically. So when it's received, it kind of forwards in and an automation parses it using something called a regular expression. And grabs the printed information, matches it to a client record, and creates a ticket against that client. Something like that, like just taking away, making the one little input step frictionless so that a ticket can be entered. Correct. Or we use this, we find this really handy for ourselves, reacting in Slack with a specific emoji to a message. So like a client will say, hey, can we modify this like graph to, show it information a different way, and we're like, oh yeah, sure, no problem. React with a little like a hand emoji, which is like our internal symbol for like a change request, and it creates a change request record in Airtable, assigns it, like figures out which client it is based on the Slack channel that it's in, and then we can track like response time and make sure that all these things are captured and sorted out, right? And so like changing, I really appreciate what you said about there, like about voice as well, because like changing. If you could just make the input of the system easier, like frictionless as possible. Correct.
Yep.
So I'll give you an example. Phenomenal. I'll give you something that I haven't quite rolled out, but just for my own needs, which is the more content that's good I write, the more money I make. And so I'm trying to think about what are the easiest ways for me to do it. And I was thinking, and none of these tools are fancy, but I'm like, how do I really nail it? And I'm like, here's what I think I would like. Randomly throughout my day, I get an SMS with a content producing question, like what's something you disagree with most people on, as an example.
Right.
Maybe it's generated.
Yeah, the old Peter Thiel question, right?
Or whatever, right? Yeah. Maybe it's something last week you wrote in your newsletter about this. Do you have any more thoughts about it? I get a text and then I respond with a voice note. And that voice note is transcribed, it's punched up, it's formatted with Claude. Great creative writer. And now I just created a great piece of content kind of like seamlessly. It wasn't me fucking going in some platform. It wasn't Tweet Hunter. It wasn't the way I don't like to make content. It was content as I experience it throughout my day, which is the best form of content to create. It wasn't batch process, so it all sounds the same. So I've been thinking a lot about where I think I'm really good is taking certain tools and finding no shit applications for them. Like, okay, everybody right. knows you can do a form in Airtable. Okay, but can I push a message in Slack and then have that find a record in CRM? Like exactly the stuff you're talking, add it to a Kanban board and also, yeah, oh yeah, I can do that, right? So I'm really good, I think, at coming up with actual practical uses for these really wide open tools that really drive outcomes, whether it's like letting me charge less money, speed up delivery, increase quality, whatever. So that's where I spend a lot of my time.
Right. Interesting. So, I mean, we should have a conversation about this because like I really enjoy that process as well. There's a couple that I've come up with recently, or not, I mean, not recently. One of our clients came up with this one, actually. I can't even claim the origin for this. But he goes, hey, like, so he's like a content writing company, and he bids on these projects, and he was just making up like an arbitrary... I built this auto bidder for him that was based on a price per page, like calculated kind of page or word count. And up to this point, we had just been kind of like guessing on the price. And so he said, well, Ryan, could you think we could like A/B split the test or split test the price? So test like $40 per page versus $45 per page. And if $45 per page wins, test 45 versus 50. And if, you know, 50 wins versus, you know, if 50 wins, test 50 versus 55. And if 50 still wins, test 50 versus 45, and kind of like keep iterating, right? And sort of hunting for the optimal price based on, you know, revenue per, he's a revenue, but I realized that it was really like marginal profit per bid was the, you know, the best metric, right? Because you need to account for changes in conversion rate, but also profitability and things like that. So I was like, oh, that's a really like clever idea. I really kind of like that because it's a very, the math is very, very simple. The infrastructure in Airtable is very, very simple for this kind of thing, right? And for him, it really made sense because it's a very high volume business with really small margins. So I was like, okay, well, like, let's just try and see what happens. Like, I have no idea what's going to happen. I have no idea what the optimal price is. Let's just like turn on go. And it turns out that in less than a month, we increased his profit by like 80 something percent.
Wow.
Simply because we were like, he was just underbidding. He happened to be underbidding, but he didn't know. And we just had that. We just like, you know, I think it went from like 15. His marginal profit per bid was like initially incredible. $15, and it went up to $28 with it just from monkeying with the numbers. And so there's like things like that that I think are super interesting.
Can I go ahead? Yeah, so this is where I think guys like that you guys are thinking about, right? I've thought about this and I've evolved, but I want to hear your guys' answer to this, which is the people who made money when refrigeration was invented weren't the people who built refrigerators, it was Coca-Cola. Mm-hmm. Right? Meaning it was the application of the technological innovation, not the technological innovation itself. I mean, the refrigeration guys did fine, right? If all you guys did in the next 6 months was build a tool that helps freelancers better price their bids using automated scraping and an easy-to-use interface, and you charged people whatever, if that's all you did with your guys' automation ability, you would probably build more enterprise value quicker than being an automation agency. Probably. Now it has to make sure you're making the right bet, right? It can't be a shitty application. But with what Ryan just described, if you got serious about that, you found a customer in pain, you found somebody who you could go out and reach and touch, and all you did was perfect that one application of AI and automation and made it better, I bet you guys could probably make more money. That's what I spent a lot of my time thinking about, which is, do I want to be in the refrigeration business or the Coca-Cola business? Because I'm sitting around going, guys, trust me, refrigeration is going to change your business. And they're dumb and slow acting.
Right.
So I'm like, I'll start Coca-Cola. Because I can do better than you for less money, faster, and at more scale. Because because you guys think, you know, using a VA is impressive, right? So like, all I mean, challenging you, Ryan, as you guys think about your next 10 years or whatever, with what you just described, that's a $50 million high ARR SaaS company if you build it right.
Yeah, so I think where we're where Tony and I have like thought about is like basically the agency is an R&D shop, and we have the benefit of being paid by clients for it to solve a high degree of pain point for a specific business, and then what we can do is then take those insights and spin them out into individual products that can be scaled to multiple people.
Right? That's like that I like because they're paying you. They're paying you to discover pain in a certain industry.
And like they're basically iterate on it, right? Iterate on it again and again and again. Because we do like a we do projects. We do like a sprint model where we develop like a smaller. It's called the agile method, right? So we I know you know because you're in the lean, right? But we don't do like a 3 month long project where we go in a dark room and come back with something like supposedly perfect. We do like a little another micro feature, implement that, see how you like it and what needs to be built next and how you're engaging with it. So we're kind of constantly iterating in the same way that, by the way, like, I mean, iOS, what's iOS on, like 27 million? Like even Apple didn't do it perfectly the first time, and they have the best, you know, arguably the best talent in the world. And so we very much believe in iteration and building with a user. But yeah, that's kind of how we're thinking about it is like, we have access
to lots of business models
from the inside because we talk to founders and we see what things they're like really benefiting from and what things they're not benefiting from. And then the next time a founder comes to us and wants to scale, then we can say, well, we've done this for like a dozen other businesses that are just like yours. And so we're pretty sure that these three things are the things I would start with. And then we kind of get started a little bit faster with them. And then they all have really crazy cool ideas as well. That sometimes we see across industries as well.
Yeah. It seems to me like, I mean, I've done a bit of this and I like it, which is you guys are on the evolution, which I'm sure somebody's written a book about or an article, which is you start with consulting, then you look for opportunities for a productized service, and then you look for opportunities for a SaaS or a product. And consulting is what pays the bills. It's high margin, but not very scalable. But then as you go, you productize it. And now you're like, get our top of funnel tool for, I mean, that's what Russ Brunson did, right?
At ClickFunnels,
right? I mean, it starts with hands-on consulting-y, but that's just until you find out some massive scalable opportunity where you're like, we help you do better janitorial bids because we scrape Craigslist every day for current market rates and allow you to bid to maximum gross margin based on available labor in your geography. You sell that to every fucking commercial janitorial company. Game on. You know, next corporate meeting's on the yacht if you figure that out.
Yeah.
So like you guys are, you know what I mean? Meaning I think a lot about game selection and business model selection. And I think you guys are in a really powerful place, which is you get paid to look under the hood. It's like letting the wolf in the hen house, right? Correct. You're in their business.
That's the idea.
Right? Yeah. They're paying you to look at their problems. And if you solve it for one of them, they all fucking have it. So it's a really cool, there's some really cool stuff there that if you guys aren't already thinking about it, I'd be thinking about how to build, you know, great business. How does it get really big? And the way I think it gets really big is productized services or SaaS probably. Based on what I know,
from you guys. And that's the idea. I mean, that's how like IT firms scale. Is like the done for you side will scale inevitably by just the sheer results, market growing, right? It will grow.
That's your customer acquisition, right? That's your customer acquisition, right? Yeah,
right. And the beauty of it is what Ryan said is the R&D is like you get the top companies in the market telling you their problems, and you're paid to solve it for them.
It's incredible.
Yeah.
Can't get better. You have people that are
they're so good at getting customers that they have an operations problem, and they're so good at getting customers that they have a bad operations problem, and it's valuable for them to solve it so they, you know, can get the next level. And you get to see like, okay, so what does everybody in SEO do? What does everybody in UGC do? What does everybody in cold email do? What does everybody in real estate do? What is what are the biggest problems with this business model? And, you know, it's super exciting. I mean, we actually just started, we just started. Tony and I met last July for the first time. It's been a fun ride. So, yeah.
Can I ask you guys a random question about something?
Yeah, go for it.
So I have a new way that I'm thinking about pricing. So I don't really do any of this because of my global talent company. We end up getting dragged into it every now and then. How would you guys feel about an automation pricing model where it's some sort of a setup fee and then all you're doing is marking up like toll road, right? So if Make charges you 1/10 of a cent, you charge 1 cent. Let's pretend that's the model. And it's usage-based pricing, but with a setup fee so that you know you're not going to like, they're only ever going to do $29 worth of automations. But I like that because you get the commitment, you make the sale, you recover your customer acquisition cost, but now you get to kind of like snake your way into their pants with a very easy pricing model. And those things are annuities because they'll never get pulled out once you built them, ever, right? And the customer's happy because it's usage-based. It's not flat fee. How do you react when I say that?
How do you react? This is super interesting because it's kind of like HubSpot does it, right? Oh, the CRM is free.
Yeah.
And then it's $29 a month. But then some people are like, how do I get, you know, this HubSpot bill for $5,000 a month? Like, how did that, like, so, and
they will never switch because people would rather.
They're never going to switch. Yeah.
Correct.
That's
lock in. I would rather give up my firstborn than turn off all my zaps and make. Literally.
Right.
My firstborn. Because it's so far inside my company.
Because it does. Right? And you know, like, no matter how much you're paying for Make or any kind of automation tool, you would have to pay way more for a person to do it manually. And so you don't do it.
Oh.
And everything would break. And
everything would break.
So I got into this because a close friend of mine was running his agency and he was convinced that he had a people management problem. He was convinced that he needed to pay more and hire from a different place and do all this kind of stuff. And I was like, well, hold on a second. Like, what is this, like, this person you're complaining about, what does she do exactly? And so long story short, automated her job and he went from 10 to 50 with $50 to $100 projects. Like a lot of them. He's the same guy we did the pricing thing for. And so like as nice. Much as, yeah, and he pays like, his Make bill is like $300 a month, but you know, I'd rather pay $300 a month and make $40,000 more than anything else.
Right? And make never calls in sick.
Right.
Right.
It never goes on vacation. It's never in a bad mood. It never needs like encouragement. It's just there. Correct. Right. And like the consistent, like the raw, people underestimate the power of just raw consistency and like instant response time. Like that trumps everything. Yeah. So the answer, I kind of like that actually, John.
Tony, I want to get your perspective because for me, right, when I think about, let's pretend I wanted to hire you guys. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm like, all right, I'm going to pay you guys 10 grand upfront once, let's call it. And you guys are going to do my architecture. You're going to identify kind of like where automation is going to be used, what very consulting-y, right? But then you're going to give me, let's say, a credit of $50 worth of automations per month for a year bundled with that 10K. So you can kind of, hey, you don't owe me any more money until you're over $50 a month worth of automation. And the way we're going to price it is basically I take whatever Zapier or Make charges me and I double it or I triple it or I whatever. It's 1 cent per automation run. So if you don't use automation, you don't ever owe me anything. If this whole project's flat, all you've done is paid me 10 grand for consulting. But now you guys get this juicy, juicy annuity that pays you fucking forever. Forever. And now you get to get all these little trickles because me as a business owner, I'm happy because if I'm not using automation, I don't pay you guys. I already paid you the 10 grand, but if I'm using it like crazy, look, I'm paying 10, what am I marking up from 1/10 of a cent to 1 cent?
Yeah.
You're never going to think about it.
I've seen this model be whipped up, not specifically in the way you're describing, but more in a way of like per process pricing. So like you would go into a company, automate a specific process, and then charge like a $500 license for that, like an RPA, like robotic process automation.
That's, I've seen that, but I don't
like
that.
That's a pricing model. Right. Me neither, right?
And Tony, the reason, reason I don't like that is because of your risk. Because if they say automate this and then it's really hard, I got to put $3,000 into it, $5,000 into it, $10,000, right? Like I'm at risk, you know? That's why I don't like that per process pricing.
Yeah.
I've been working on this thing.
I guess the distinction would be, it's kind of like the whole, it's the never ending, like, do you do a build and release or do you have like a SaaS, right? Or do you pay like kind of the service thing, and there's always people that want
And I'm arguing charging it more like a SaaS.
There's probably people on either side of the fence there, right? So there's some people that would prefer to pay the lifetime. You know, so far we've been pricing it as like you kind of pay to like the lifetime. So we do the build or release kind of model where we build it for you, but you own the infrastructure. And then, of course, like the never ending risk with that for the client is like, well, I don't know how useful this is going to be. I don't know how long I'm going to stay in this business model, and you know, whatever else.
Yep.
It's interesting for sure.
Versus instead of charging them $15,000, you just say, look, I'm essentially going to finance it for you. The way I'm going to finance it for you is charge you 10 cents in automation, minimum $200 a month, and that's just maintenance. And then any additional uses are just 1 cent each. And now you're basically leasing back them. It's like SaaS. You basically lease it back to them.
Yeah. Right?
And now they're like, great, I get to amortize my costs. You know, if it breaks, I can talk to them. They'll fix it. And you guys are like, shit, man. Now over time, you just get this juicy, juicy revenue stream that just turns, it's like royalties. It turns into this tidal wave. So I've just been thinking about pricing automation like that. I'd be curious. If you guys do any more thinking on it, I'd be interested in your perspective.
Yeah, I mean it is super. Yeah, it's very, very interesting. We have been thinking about it. Like, so one pricing change we made recently was we realized very quickly that if you cannot build automations on top of like a Google Sheet or ClickUp or something, like it will fall apart. It will be a disaster. It will be very hard to maintain. Right?
Yep.
So we start with a relational database design in Airtable, and we really want people to use it in manual mode for like enough time to get used to it before we start adding automation on top of it, because we want to make sure that people are bought into like this way of working. And we, you know, oftentimes like if you have like the data synchronized in one place, it can solve a lot of the bottlenecks for you. Right. So a lot of businesses especially that are, you know, below 20 to 30 a month, like really don't need a lot of automation at all. If any, like very minimal automation, right? Whereas like above 100, now you're talking into like real territory work. This can make it like a huge difference for your business. But we used to do the Airtable build out as part of the sprint model. But the problem was some companies were very quick on change management. Some were very like they wanted a little bit more time to organize their team, or maybe they were scaling fast and they had a bunch of new team members. They couldn't kind of, they needed to kind of organize themselves internally as well as use this new system. And so we found that like you have to synchronize.
That's why you charge minimums in the
setup. You have to charge it as a one-time project because with no time limit, because otherwise when the time rolls by and you build somebody again, they haven't really like received any kind of new value from you. It's a bad experience, right?
And they're not going to want to pay another bill.
Right.
Yeah, they're not going to want to pay
another bill. Right. And so I do think like you need to synchronize the value someone's getting with the, like the bill with the value, right? Which is why Netflix doesn't charge by the day.
That's why I like this usage.
Right.
That's why I like this usage, right? Because like we've got some stuff where it's like, oh, you know, it's unlimited, $5,000 a month, $10,000 a month, whatever. And then they have a month where they don't use it. And like, you know, there's no, and then
and
they get another $5,000.
Bill, you know, the bill, and they're like, "Well, I didn't pay.
Correct.
I want to pause it. I, you know." So there's like this like awkward stopping thing. Yeah,
correct. Versus you say something like, "Here's how this works. I look at your project, I tell you what the setup fee is going to be, and you guys just think that's not your huge profit center, but you don't want to be in your pocket. We'll set you up this. Great. It's $7,000. And then it's built on our infrastructure, which we'll maintain, right? If it breaks, we'll fix it. But we mark up the instances of the automation by a couple cents. Right. And now you just, right? But in, it's like a managed service. But, and now it's like, now it's easy for me to say yes to that, because if I'm not using it, I don't pay.
Yeah. Love that.
So that's why I was thinking about it. So yeah, we can talk about something else, but I just want to hear your guys' reaction to it.
Yeah. Yeah. Some, we'll think about this. We'll think about it offline, because that's super interesting.
Yeah. And by the way, I'll tell you from an enterprise value perspective, if you guys go to an acquirer one day and you want to sell your company, if you're an agency, right, your multiples are 2 to 4 times earnings. But if you guys say, we have annuities based on these automation markups, some of them have been around for 2 or 3 years, those things are going to get valued like fucking 10x, 15x, right? Because you guys don't have to do anything.
Like SaaS.
Right? It's like royalties. You guys don't have to do anything. And they're like, oh, do you have upward pricing power? And we're like, we could triple our prices and they wouldn't switch because we're so far inside their company. That's huge enterprise value creation. So yeah, there could be something there. We'll talk about it.
Love it. I think we're going to have to wrap with this thought as an enigma. And then part two will be, did OpsKings actually implement this pricing model?
Right. And all I need is a little bit of a, you know, consulting fee, you know, because of this idea.
Some little annuity. Just
yeah,
annuity.
That's why it is just what might be. Yeah, the $7,000 podcast fee. You know, John, the best thing about doing a podcast is you just do all the free consulting you want from somebody. So it's actually.
Yeah, right. I know. This isn't even going to get released. This isn't even going to get released.
It doesn't
we're
have
just
to
keep
be.
It internal.
We're I just, not even recording.
Because I've spent a lot of time. Why is an automation more popular? And there's a couple reasons which we could talk about, but one of the things I think is the pricing model is a little bit off for a lot of companies. There's room for innovation in pricing model. So I've been spending a lot of time thinking about that. There's other ways to do it too, which we could talk about.
Love it. Well, I think we're gonna have to wrap for round one. So. Thank you, John. Actually, here's a question, last question, and then I promise we'll wrap here. John, we don't have a name for the podcast yet. What do you think we should name the podcast?
Yacht Week.
There we go.
Yacht Week.
There we go. Yeah, love it.
That's it.
Coming to you live from Yacht Week here in Croatia.
That's good. I love it.
Love it.
Good.
But yeah, man. Cool.
John,
all right, well, we're gonna wrap.
All right, let's wrap here.